This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 10 years ago, President Clinton's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue policy triggered an explosive debate on gays and lesbians in the military. Before 1993, are you a homosexual was one of the questions on the military's enlistment contract. Answering yes meant automatic disqualification. Subsequent discovery was, by definition, a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The new policy was a compromise that no one was very happy with, on Capitol Hill, in the military, or among gay activists. In theory, the military would not ask service members about their sexual preferences, and gays and lesbians could continue to serve so long as they kept their sex lives private. In practice, enforcement is uneven at best, and gays in the military say their ambiguous legal status forces them into conflict with their identity and their honor. But many in the military argue that allowing gays to serve openly would threaten unit cohesion and discipline, which are critical to effectiveness and national security. This hour, we'd be especially interested to hear from current and former members of the armed services about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What's your experience been? Do you think the current policy works? And if not, what should it be? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Last week, two generals and an admiral, now retired, disclosed that they are gay and kept their homosexuality private throughout their military careers. Two of them join us now. Keith Kerr retired in 1995 after 31 years in the Army and the Army Reserves. He retired with the rank of Brigadier General. He joins us from the studios of member station KRCB in Rohnert Park, California, and welcome.
Thank you, Neil.
Rear Admiral Alan Steinman spent 28 years in the Coast Guard and was its Surgeon General when he retired in 1997. And he's with us from the studios of member station KPLU in Tacoma, Washington. And it's good of you to join us today.
Good afternoon, Neil.
General Kerr, why did you decide to come out now?
I wanted to come out to make a statement that don't ask, don't tell, after 10 years is not working. Since 1993, we've had 10,000 members of our armed forces discharged on the basis of homosexuality. And these people were not guilty of misconduct. They were simply doing their job. I believe that sexual orientation has absolutely no bearing on the ability to perform a job. And these discharges amounted to a great loss of talented personnel and cost our country $300 million to train replacements. And it's time that those of us who've served in the military and believe that gays can do a commendable job step forward and challenge Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and work to repeal this law that's been so ineffective and has affected the lives of thousands of people.
Rear Admiral Steinman, same question to you.
Yes, I certainly agree with what my colleague General Kerr had said, that after 10 years, this being the 10th anniversary of the enactment of the legislation, it's probably time to rethink the policy. By coming out, we hope to encourage other veterans to step forward, just so that the military and the public can see the number of gay, lesbian, and bisexual service members who have served honorably. But in addition, we think that over the 10 years, there's been an accumulation of empirical evidence that might be useful for Congress and the military to examine to see whether we want to continue this policy or not.
General Kerr, let me ask you, you are obviously in the military for a long time. You've also been retired for a long time. Why did you not come out before now?
Well, I grew up in a generation in the 40s and 50s, and our attitudes were much different then. One kept one's personal life to oneself. An individual who acknowledged that they were gay or lesbian could not get a job, could not get hired, was subject to instant dismissal. I didn't accept my sexuality until approximately 10 years after I went into the military service.
And what was it like at that point to realize, as you say, accept your sexuality, but realize that you were in this terrible situation?
Well, I had to do the best with what I could, and I was concentrating on my job, trying to serve my country. So I kept my personal life to myself and said that I'm going to make the best career I can. And over these years, the Army was wonderful to me. It gave me training, it gave me education, it gave me travel. I was able to serve under very talented officers and learn from them. And so I'm a much better person because I served my country in the military. I also pursued a civilian career while serving in the reserve. Mm-hmm. But there are thousands of young Americans out there who want to serve and are hesitant to do so because of this military policy.
And Rear Admiral Steinman, again, sort of the same question. Would this statement not have been a lot more effective and a lot more, you know, gotten a lot more attention if you'd made it while you were still in the service?
Well, Neil, you have to understand that the law, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, prohibits one from admitting one's sexual orientation. If you do, you are subject to being separated or discharged from the military. The law requires you to be silent. And the Uniform Code of Military Justice requires you to be celibate. So there was really no way to step forward and say, I'm gay. Besides which, I was willing to, in order to serve my country, and I was in the United States Coast Guard for mm-hmm. most of my career, I was willing to sacrifice my personal life in order to stay in the Coast Guard. The personal job satisfaction I gained by being in the Coast Guard, the contributions I made to the Coast Guard, I found very valuable. To this day, I very much value my affiliation with the U.S. Coast Guard. Love the people and I love the missions the Coast Guard do, and did not want to upset that situation. So that plus the constraints of the law required me to make that sacrifice.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Jeff, who joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, how you doing? I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I find that this is even an issue. It's so arcane, I believe, that I was in the military, the Air Force, in the early 80s, before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I am gay. And I grew up here in the South, so I know how some of the attitudes can be. But it was much easier for us then to be gay and in the military because everybody knew that there were gays in the military and that they tended to be overachievers and they tended to, really become really good, successful soldiers. But after Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I was already out of the military then, it seems to have turned into a bit of a fiasco and it's become much more difficult. And it was a compromise deal anyway, on Clinton's part. But what I feel to understand is it seems to me that the people that are going to have a problem on the battlefield with gays, that the problem is theirs, not the men and women who are gay and serving. You know, they should be judged on their skills and their abilities and their dedication and not something as, something like their sexual orientation. I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, thanks for the call, Jeff. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
General Kerr, let's put that to you. I mean, you were in the obviously in the Army and the Army Reserves before and after Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Was it better before?
I don't detect a great deal of difference. We see some commands today very aggressively pursuing investigations. It probably depends on the attitude of the commander and the non-commissioned officers on how actively they pursue gays. The investigative techniques are terrible. They'll seize diaries, emails, personal letters. These are all things that should be private to an individual. But I think basically what the caller is asking about is the question of unit cohesion. And this argument has been around for a long time, and I'd like to make some extended remarks about unit cohesion. Back in 1947, President Truman wanted to integrate the armed forces, and every general and admiral in the Defense Department said, oh, if we integrate the armed forces and allow Afro-Americans to serve alongside Caucasians, it will disrupt unit cohesion. And there was only one general officer on active duty, General Lucian Truscott, who had the guts to stand up and say, that's not so. Well, despite the arguments of the generals and the admirals, Truman went ahead and integrated the armed forces anyway. And we have a fine fighting team today. We have the best military in the world. And the argument today is that if you let gays and lesbians serve in the military forces, it will destroy unit cohesion.
Well, let's get a caller on the line, and this is Ronnie, who's with us from Eden, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Ronnie. You're on the air.
How you doing? I'm retired military, 21 years, and I was in a combat MOS, and neither one of you were in a combat MOS, correct?
That's correct for me.
Admiral Steinman?
I was in the Coast Guard. The type of combat we did was, I was certainly in life-threatening situations, search and rescue, but not in the type of combat that the caller is talking about.
Okay, Ron.
I guess my point is, I was a combat engineer in the Army for 21 years, and also as a leader, I retired first sergeant. I could tell you that there are conflicts with homosexuals in the military. I mean, we can beat around the bush and we can try to overlook it or whatever. And you're correct when you say that, yes, there are people who's known to be homosexual, but they don't display it or they don't make it known. But the point is when you're in a track and you're in a desert and you got seven other people with you in that track, you can cause problems, not just for the soldiers in the squad, but for the leaders.
Ronnie, what about the point that General Kerr just made, that a lot of people made that same argument when the military was African-Americans were allowed into military units, and I guess the same argument could be made about women?
Well, in my view, that's apples and oranges. That's two different things. I mean, you're talking about, you know, it's as far as the mentality, as far as race, I don't know what the mentality for race and integrating in the military as far as soldier level goes, because I was a non-commissioned officer,
mm-hmm.
but for the officer level, I think they the ones who had the problems with it. I don't think it was the enlisted soldiers. Now I'm just guessing on that. Now, as far as comparing that to today and putting homosexuals into a combat unit, there are going to be problems. There's no way you're going to get around with it. They're having so many problems right now with just sexual harassment, and now we're going to throw in something else into it. In my opinion, it's not going to work.
Let's get a quick response.
I'd like to respond to
Admiral Steinman. Yeah.
May I comment on that, Neil?
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me comment on the callers. There are a couple things. First, we, our organization, Service Members Legal Defense Network, actually has been in contact with gay soldiers in both Iraq and Afghanistan who are out to their unit, and they are in a fighting force and has not created a problem, according to their report. Also, I think our listeners need to understand that if you look at our military allies, all of them used to have a ban on gays and lesbians serving openly in the military. They have all removed that ban except for Greece and Turkey. And so they have not, and they have not reported a problem. And in particular, let's look at Israel. Nobody could possibly question the combat effectiveness of the Israeli armed forces. And yet, long ago, they removed the ban on gay and lesbian soldiers. And let's look at the United Kingdom. We're fighting shoulder to shoulder right now in Iraq with our British allies. The British do not have a ban on gays serving in the military.
Ronnie, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the military's policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which President Clinton enacted 10 years ago in an executive order. Our guests are Army Reserve Brigadier General Keith Kerr and retired Rear Admiral Alan Steinman, who retired from the Coast Guard. They both recently came out publicly after serving almost 30 years in their respective branches. You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jason, who's with us from Heidelberg, Germany.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I've been listening to your program, actually, on a television program here in Heidelberg. And I just wanted to put in my two cents about the whole thing. I've been serving now for about 4 years with the United States Army, and I was listening to the general that was on, speaking of basically the kind of witch hunt that goes on in some units, and then another unit that's kind of relaxed about who they do pursue as far as discharging goes. And about a month ago now, I actually went to my first sergeant because the military's policy on it has been causing me a lot of personal problems as far as just being honest with myself and with my friends and family, and also the whole marriage aspect of it and things like that. I'd like to have a life, and I love serving my country, but with this policy, I cannot remain in the United States military and pursue happiness. But I went to my first sergeant about a month ago now, and I told him that I was gay and about my problems that I was having, and that I've been having some problems with alcohol recently because of these struggles. And basically he told me that he'd put me into counseling about it if I wanted, but he couldn't really do anything else for me. And you know, for me, it's still day by day just a personal struggle through all of these topics. And I was wondering what the general might have to say about that, what he might comment on that about.
General Kerr?
Well, I would urge you to concentrate on your job, finish out your enlistment, and if you feel uncomfortable, then leave the service at the end of your enlistment. And I wish you the very best. And I just have to say that the military culture over the last 60 years has been homophobic, and it's passed down as a male bonding tradition, in my opinion. The military culture is susceptible to change. When I was first commissioned, you were expected to go and drink with the troops on Friday night. And then later on, as alcohol abuse became more and more apparent, that began to change. And in troop training, we instituted alcohol and drug abuse training. And today, officers and NCOs don't feel that they have to are required or compelled to drink with the troops. So that would be my advice. I urge you to finish your enlistment and go home, and so that you can say, I've done a good job and I've served my country well.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call, Jason.
Appreciate your service, too.
Okay. Jason, may I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Admiral Steinman.
You've told your first sergeant that you were gay. Do other members of your unit know that you're gay?
Practically my entire unit does, sir, and it hasn't really caused many problems. Most people are pretty accepting of it, but it's still day by day.
It's hard on you.
It's very hard on me, yes, sir.
Can you tell us what kind of unit you're in, Jason?
Right now, sir, I'm a field artillery soldier, but I'm serving on a special duty with a band over in Europe, sir.
And is it possible that, as you say, different units have different practices? It's not as big an issue in the band as it might be in the field artillery?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure of that, sir. And I will be PCSing back to the field artillery, so that's going to be an interesting event here in the next few months.
I don't envy you the next few months, Jason.
Well, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Let's have another caller on the line, and this is Bob, and Bob's in Greenville, North Carolina.
Yes, I have a question for either the Admiral or the General. If they would agree with me that our society, and particularly the military and the society in general, would not accept a heterosexual man who is attracted by nature to females walking through the locker room and shower room of the ladies or the women in the military, how can they find it acceptable for a homosexual man who's attracted by definition to men to be walking through the locker room and shower room with men, or vice versa if it was a lesbian?
Admiral Steinman?
I think the answer to that is the caller needs to realize, and our listeners need to realize, the law currently permits gay men and lesbians and bisexuals to serve in the military. So the homosexuals and the gays are there already in the locker rooms, the birthing areas and whatnot, and it obviously is not a problem.
Well, maybe the heterosexual men ought to apply for equal rights and be able to walk through a ladies' locker room.
Bob, thanks very much for the call. And let's try to get now to Dave. And Dave's in Landstuhl. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, in Germany.
Landstuhl, Germany.
Yes.
The issues I have are I get a bit offended when we talk about our founding fathers giving rights to races and genders, but not to sexual deviation. So to compare the integration of blacks in the military in the 40s to a sexual deviation integration, I think is a far fetch. Secondly, I think that other countries have integrated gays in non-leadership and leadership positions. However, I argue that the United States has the number one fighting force in the world, and they don't. And the third is, the gay problem is a very intangible issue. I can't tell you that having a gay in my unit, after having led combat units for 18 years, I can't tell you, can't put my finger on how a gay does it. There's not 16% lack of efficiency. The problem you run into is it's an intangible number, or it's intangible, and you can't put your finger necessarily on what the problem is, but you have to experience it, and that's why the military has a difficult time capturing that.
Dave, do you think that there have never been gays in your unit?
No, I do. And I think that I have served with people that were, the perception was they were gay, whether they were or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a huge problem in infantry platoons and rifle platoons.
General Kerr.
Well, my theory is that the training cadre and the NCOs and the officers, a lot of times, have institutionalized this dislike for gays. The cadre often belittle soldiers in training to motivate them. You skinny little rat! How are you going to charge up that hill with a machine gun? Or this platoon looks like a bunch of faggots dancing around a maypole. Well, the officer, the NCO, may not really believe that, but the problem is that sometimes you get an immature person or someone who's looking for a person to hate is going to internalize that, and then it becomes part of their persona, and they're looking to harass
deviation.
Gays.
I think that's a second or third deviation issue. I mean, I don't think that's the issue. The issue is I had guys that were not gay, perceived as gays in my unit, and I had to constantly protect those guys because of what the other people were doing.
Well, that's one of our complaints. We ought to be having anti-harassment training. And the Pentagon's been dragging its feet for 10 years on anti-harassment training.
And
their plan is sitting on
it. Anti-harassment training I have on a daily basis that cuts into my mission time.
Dave, if the gays were allowed, if the policy were changed and gays were allowed to serve openly, you're on active service, I take it.
Yes.
What would your response be? Would you feel that the Army was reducing its effectiveness? Would you stay in the Army?
Absolutely. I feel it's reducing effectiveness. Unfortunately, I'm at my point in the career where it's financially unconstrainable not to stay in the service. So the issue is I would retire at the soonest possible moment.
Thank you very much for the call, Dave.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Let's get one more caller in. This is Julie, who's with us from Oakland, California.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on how one of the, I think, often overlooked issues with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and discrimination against gay and lesbian people, bisexual people in the military in general, is how it impacts the families of these people. The family members, as with family members of heterosexual members of the military, play a critical role in supporting our troops. They undergo the same stressors and more, perhaps because of these policies, as the families of heterosexual soldiers, and yet there's essentially nowhere that they can turn within the military for the important kinds of support that are available to and promoted to heterosexual families. And also in the gay, lesbian, and bisexual community, sometimes resources can feel inaccessible because of maybe aversive feelings, sentiments about the military because of the history of discriminatory treatment against the gay and lesbian community. And I think it's a really important thing to notice. I mean, even going to kiss your loved one goodbye as they go off to Iraq to risk their lives for our country, becomes a very problematic moment for people. And I don't think the solution is to get rid of people who are gay in the military. I think the solution is to develop supports for them and their families and for the people who are, perhaps homophobic so that they can understand what a critical resource these talented people are, and really support our troops in that way. And I'll take comments off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Julie. Go ahead, Admiral Steinman.
I thank the caller for her views. I think the part of the answer is the military and the legislation that's passed, and I just don't tell, creates the fiction that gays and lesbians don't have families. In order to follow the law and to serve in the military on active duty, you have to be silent and celibate, and the celibate by implication would mean you have no family. So I think that's probably the reason why the military doesn't address that issue, but the caller is absolutely right. Loved ones of gay and lesbian service members have those same problems, suffer the same degree of fears that their friends have when their friends are deployed into a war zone, and yet they can't express it. They can't welcome them back home in the same way, and it's really kind of a tragedy.
General Kerr, before we let you go, we're in a situation, in a political situation, where obviously the issue of gay marriage is now very much up before the American public. Yesterday on television, the President of the United States said he would support a constitutional amendment to prohibit gay marriage if he thought it was necessary, and that he might do that. As a practical political matter, do you foresee this policy changing anytime soon?
The DADT policy, no. We think we can build enough support in Congress for the policy to be repealed in about 5 years. It's a matter of education. It's a matter of promoting tolerance. Just as a final parting shot, I've got an original cartoon by Tom Tolles on my wall at home, and it shows two Army officers, obviously high rank, and they're talking while the troops are jumping out of a helicopter and storming a barracks. And they're saying, we may not have gotten all the Al-Qaeda, but today we rooted out two gay American soldiers and seized a cache of love letters. Come on. Is this what we ought to be doing with our armed forces?
General Kerr, thanks very much for being with us. Retired Brigadier General Keith Kerr was with us from the studios of Member Station KCRB in Rohnert Park, California. And Admiral Steinman, we appreciate your time today as well.
My pleasure.
Retired Rear Admiral Alan Steinman was with us from the studios of Member Station KPLU in Tacoma, Washington. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now to discuss how Don't Ask, Don't Tell is working 10 years after its implementation are two people who were involved very early on in the creation of the policy 10 years ago. Rear Admiral John Hudson served 28 years in the Navy from 1997 to 2000. He was a judge advocate general responsible for enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He's now dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, and he joins us from New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. And good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Charles Moskos, one of the architects of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, professor of sociology at Northwestern University, joining us from the studios on the campus in Evanston, Illinois. And good to have you back on the program, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Tell us a little bit, Charlie, if you would, about the genesis of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, the genesis was that during the early months of the Clinton administration, it was sinking under his proposal to lift entirely the gay ban. And when I came up with this compromise, which I originally titled Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Seek, Don't Flaunt, and then became shortened to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I approached various members in the administration, Senator Sam Nunn and the then chairman of the House Senate Armed Services Committee, and Les Aspin, then Secretary of Defense. And through that policy, the wheels began to move, eventually resulting in the law that actually is stricter than Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The law, everybody forgets, has in it, homosexuality is incompatible with military service. That's a direct quote. While Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a milder application of the law in the military.
Now, did you consider that a compromise right from the start, or did you say this is really going to work, this is the best idea?
Well, it's the best idea of the time, and it seems to have lasted much better than I expected. It reminds me of what Churchill is supposed to have said about democracy. It's the worst system possible, except for any other.
And 10 years later, you think it still serves its objectives?
Surprisingly well. I might add, I was a former draftee, too, during the Cold War military. And, of course, there were known gays in our unit, combat engineers, as well as a lot of known homophobes, as even much greater number. So we've always had known gays in the military. That's nothing new. But open gays, that has not happened in the American forces.
Now, Admiral Hudson, you were part of the team that helped write the policy 10 years ago, then executive assistant to the then JAG, Judge Advocate General of the Navy. What were the discussions like at that time in trying to come up with the language?
Well, it's almost embarrassing in 2003 to go back and describe them. We worried about, if we open the ranks to the gays, are the gays going to come flooding in and drive the heterosexuals out, and we'll end up with some sort of Spartan military that's all gay? You know, we went through these crazy discussions about, well, let me see, if you have gay men, you put them with the heterosexual women so that they won't be, you know, it was that kind of crazy stuff. And we were legitimately, honestly concerned that we would significantly undermine the unit cohesion and thereby the effectiveness of the United States military, whose mission is, after all, to fight and win the nation's wars. That was paramount.
And we just have a few seconds before we have to go to a break, but 10 years later, how do you think it's working?
Well, I don't think it's working very well. It, with all due respect to Professor Moskos, it was the best we could do at the time, but I don't think anybody looks at it as a great success, other than perhaps it bought us 10 years of time to grow up and to mature as a society and as an armed force.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, what do Arthurian legends, the Battle of the Somme, and the industrialization of England have in common? All part of the geography of Middle Earth. We'll explore J.R.R. Tolkien's life and literary inspirations, The Lord of the Rings, tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gays in the military, 10 years after it became law. Our guests are retired Rear Admiral John Hudson, a former JAG, Judge Advocate General in the United States Navy, and Charles Moskos, a military sociologist who helped write the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy during the Clinton administration. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-8255. Talk. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Admiral Hudson's line has just left us. Charlie Moskos, in the meantime, I did want to ask you, what about the argument society has changed over the past decade? Acceptance of gays has progressed a lot more than the situation that was in 1993, that it's time to change this policy now.
I think that is an interesting but ultimately fallacious argument. The real argument for Don't Ask, Don't Tell is sexual orientation. I think when you had a previous caller, Bob, your guest did not really give his questions the proper response.
This was the question about walking through the shower room.
Showers. That's a real central point. You can say that, well, you have open gays and heterosexual males can share the same showers. Then anybody who argues that position should say there should be no gender-separated showers as well. Sexual orientation is sexual orientation, and prudes have rights as well. By the way, at my age, I wish I had a sexual orientation. but that it's interesting, too, that the university, which often won't let ROTC and military recruiters on campus because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, most of these universities sponsor a similar program in freshman dorm policies. About the only way you can get out of a freshman dorm situation is if a straight and a gay are roomed together and one wants out, the universities almost always will let you out. So I think we do respect personal privacy and intimate living conditions.
What about the situation? And again, this has been brought up by people who disagree. The Israeli army seems to have worked this out, the British army.
Well, except that's the party line. I just come back from Iraq where I was able to talk to some British soldiers about this. And their reaction, I said, well, what do you think about the lifting of the gay ban? And there was one most of disgust. Now, they said, yes, there are gays, especially in the administrative roles. And they noted that they're lesbians, of course, if they've always been around, but not in the combat arms. I heard two different British soldiers tell me, this was just so, not that it's true at all, but that Blair was queer. Now, if that's the kind of reaction you're getting from the British forces on the ground, then you can imagine what's happening. Now, in Israel, you're also getting the party line. But in Israel, my sources say that there is no open gaze allowed, no open gaze in the combat arms as well. So you do get this kind of official line that everything's hunky-dory. Then you actually talk to soldiers. You get a quite a different picture of what's happening.
Admiral Hudson is back with us, and I wanted to raise the point that Charlie Moskos just made. While your line was down briefly, we apologize for the technical problems there. But do you think sexuality is at the heart of this? And he may have just gone again. That little chirp may have been a problem. Anyway, let's get a caller on the line while we try to fix the circuit to Admiral Hudson. And Joe joins us from North Dakota.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the line, Joe.
Yeah, great. It's Captain Joe Getz here from the Canadian Army. Driving in North Dakota, so the background noise you hear is vehicles driving by.
Well,
we've had this situation going for quite some time, and it is true that it's similar to allowing colored and black people into the forces. Back in the early 40s and into World War II, the Canadian Army and Navy had policy actually written in place prohibiting this. And what it takes is a complete mindset, a mind change, rather, of the people involved. We've been going through this for a number of years. It's not only that, it's women as well in the combat arms, and we now allow that. Are there going to be problems? Absolutely. Okay, but that's what leadership is for, and that's our jobs as leaders in the Army to ensure that our orders and regulations are enforced. And it takes a bit of guts and humility to do that sometimes, but it is possible to do. And it's working for us. Yes, I will admit there are problems, and there always will be. However, you also have problems between heterosexual soldiers as well. I mean, they go out getting scraps and all that stuff. So I look back at it as I remember a picture of a little black girl going into a school when they first desegregated.
Yes.
And that's probably where you guys are at now. And eventually that's going to change, and it will take a mind change, as well as a lot of leadership to do that.
Neil, can I respond to that quickly?
Go ahead.
There's something very salient, because it's raised not just by our Canadian caller, by many others, on the racial analogy to the sexual orientation analogy, that it's almost always raised by white people. Many blacks, and we've had surveys on this, find that an offensive analogy. You have the interesting phenomenon, by the way, in the military on gay discharges, that whites are about three times more likely to be discharged for homosexuality, than our black service members. And what causes that? They're not obviously picking on white people, but it has a much bigger stigma in the black community than it does in the typical white community. And I think that kind of racial analogy is offensive to many blacks.
Joe,
okay, I'm sorry if I offended anybody.
No, don't, please don't worry about that, Joe, Ed, but we want you to drive carefully. Sounds like you're in some traffic there.
Watch the snow.
And Joe's now with us. We're trying to get Admiral Hudson back on the phone, and he is back with us?
I think so.
Admiral Hudson?
Am I?
Yes, you're back with us.
Am I here?
Yes, you are. Well, we've let Charlie Moskos by default have the have the podium while you're in your absence, so we're going to go back to
you. I'm
sure
he did well.
Well, he did well from his point of view, and I'm trying to get – you guys are both familiar with each other's arguments, I'm quite sure. John Hudson, how do you reply to Charlie Moskos' arguments?
Well, I think a couple of ways. I think that the showering privacy argument is a red herring at best, and maybe a euphemism for prejudice at the worst. Nobody is suggesting that men and women shower together, and there's no reason to believe that letting gays be open in the military is going to somehow inexorably lead to men and women showering together. Secondly, I think it's a false analogy because heterosexuals showering with gays happens all the time in locker rooms, police and fire stations, summer camps, you know, university dorms and the like around the country. Men and women showering together doesn't happen in those contexts. So that, gays are showering with, to the extent we have gang showers, and even that's not, you know, that's kind of a World War II example, but it's happening all the time now. This is a little bit like my granddaughter who covers her eyes and thinks that everybody's left the room. They gays are there now, and the walls haven't come tumbling down. You might as well know who they are as not know who they are, it seems to me.
Also, as your experience as a judge advocate general, let me ask you about enforcement. Why is it tolerated that enforcement is so wildly different in different units?
Well, that's an example of something that happens in the military and in society generally. I mean, with regard to not only with regard to don't ask, don't tell, but also in military justice kinds of matters, we leave things up to what we refer to oftentimes as the local commander. It's not significantly unlike what happens within and among various jurisdictions across the country, civilian jurisdiction. So, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world. Now, what is the worst thing in the world, I think, is that we are putting people in a position where they're having to make these kinds of decisions based on, you know, a person's sexuality, which to me at this point in 2003 doesn't make a lot of sense. I heard one of the callers talking about the way that it's working among the soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines. Mm-hmm. I think that for years we have asked them to live down to our expectations rather than living up to our expectations.
And Admiral Hudson has his line has nuked yet again, and we apologize for that. Charlie Moskos, we may end up finishing up with you, but obviously there are gays in the military now.
And have always been.
And have always been. And their service, for the most part, like everybody's service, for the most part, has been honorable. But doesn't this policy put them in the situation of having to choose between honoring their commitment to the United States military and honoring their identity as to who they are? It's a terrible conflict that people
have. Yes, it is. But two cheers for hypocrisy. The point here is that prudes and heterosexuals also have rights, which we seem to be ignoring. And notice, even on the calls, you're getting different responses from, you know, if you're talking to senior officers as opposed to lower enlisted persons, such as my own experience, you're getting quite different kinds of reactions. Somebody even mentioned, one of your callers, about these classes on anti-gay harassment classes. When I was a soldier in the Elvis Presley era, I bought a girl's bicycle in Germany, and my comrades teased me. Today, those same comrades would be punished by the military. Now, that to me is just going too far. So it's not a perfect world, but heterosexuals also have rights if they don't want to have intimate living conditions, as do women and men. And I think you can't slide over that analogy. So you say, well, we don't really have women and men integrated because women and men do go their separate ways when it comes to intimate living conditions in the military.
And I'm sure you've heard this argument before, but it sounds an awful lot to some degree as if you're saying, well, it's difficult for them, I'm okay.
That's part of it. But then where do you also, I would like to ask the Admiral Hudson if we can get him back on the line, should transvestites be allowed into the military as well? And if not, why not? We can say we can grow up to meet that kind of standard as well. So we do have, gays are discriminated against, therefore should there be affirmative action for gays? Should there be Gay Pride Week in the military? These are the kinds of issues I like to hear people address.
Admiral Hudson is back, and you're going to get the last 30 seconds or so. If your line holds up.
All right. I'll talk fast. What am I responding to? Give
it. Well, one of the things Charlie Moskos was saying, where does it stop? Transvestites? Gay Pride Day in the military?
I mean, that's the same. I mean, that's the same old argument. We'll create the worst possible scenario, and we will let that stand for the proposition of what we ought to do with gays in the military. You know, we're talking about gays in the military. We're not talking about the whole issue right now. My point is that in 2003, the American fighting men and women, if we ask them to do it, will follow orders, will live up to the expectations that we set for them, and when this finally happens, and it is absolutely sure to happen someday, 5 years from now, as somebody suggested earlier, or at another point, mm-hmm. It's going to happen, and we're going to look back on it, and it's going to be a big yawn, and it's not going to be the huge problem, I don't think, that everybody thinks it's going to be, because the young people, the 18, 19, 20-year-olds, are just going to be able to deal with it. It's not going to be the problem that it was for for Charlie, for example, you know, back in the Elvis Presley era. We're a long ways past Elvis Presley. Elvis is dead, whether we like it or not.
I've seen him around a few places. Anyway.
I wish you were still alive.
John Hudson, thank you very much for being with us, if sporadically. Again, we apologize for the technical problems.
It's been my pleasure.
John Hudson, now Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, and he joined us from New Hampshire Public Radio. And Charlie Moscoso, always good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for asking. It was my pleasure to tell.
Charles Moscos is professor of sociology at Northwestern University and joined us from the studios on the campus there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.